सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। So, do you want me to quickly chant the Gita shlokas before we get into these shlokas? Okay, it will not take a long time, maybe about 3 4 minutes. Okay, and anyone has a soft copy of it?
You want me to flash it?
Yeah, which one? The Partha Ipati Bodhidham one. Do you have that?
Acha, Gita chanting you want. That is
Yeah, yeah. The
okay.
first the by Madhusudan Saraswati, if anyone has it.
No, I don't have that.
Okay. So, yeah, maybe I'll just chant maybe one or two shlokas in that, because I don't think without seeing the thing, if we
I
follow
can
it,
help
we'll.
you. I mean, I know it.
Okay. No, but what I'm saying is, for the rest of the people, if without
Sure.
seeing it, it may not make sense. Okay. So we might as well try to get a soft copy and then do it. But we'll do maybe one or two shlokas. Okay, let me just start out. Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Gratitham Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrutavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambat Twamanusandadhami Bhagavad-gīte bhavad-dveshini Namostu te Vyasa-viśāla-buddhe Pullāra-vindāya-tapatra-netra Yena Twaya-bhārata-taila-purnaha Prajvalito-jñānamayah-pradīpaha. So Sakubai is sharing this. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just chant it and you can follow what is there on the screen. Namostu te Vyasa Vishala Buddhe Pullara Vindaya Tapatra Netra Yena Twaya Bharata Taila Purnaha Prajwalito Gnanamaya Pradipaha Prapanna Parijataya Totra Vetraika Panaye Jnana Mudraya Krishnaya Gitamrutaduhe Namaha Sarvopanishado Gavo Dogdha Gopala Nandana Partho Vatsa Sudhir Bhokta Dugdham Gitamrutam Mahat Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chadura Maddanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagadgurum Bhishma Drona Tata Jayadratajala Gandharani Lotpala Shalyagrahavati Krupena Vahani Karnena Velakula Ashwatthama Vikarna Ghora Makara Duryodhanavartini Sotirna Kalu Pandavairananadi Kaivartaka Keshavaha Parasharyavachasarojamamalam Gitartha Gandotkatam Nanakhyanakakesaram Harikatha Sambodhana Bodhitam Loke Sajjana Shatpadairaharaha Pepiyamanam Muda Bhuvyad Bharata Pankajam Kalimala Pradvamsina Shreyase Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langhayate Girim Yatkrupatamaham Vande Paramanandamadhavam Yam Brahma Varunendra Rudra Marutaha Stunvanti Divyaistavaihi Vedai Sangapadakramopanishadaihi Gayanti Yam Samagaha Dhyanavasthita Tadgatena Manasa Pashyanti Yam Yogino Yasyantanna Vidussura Suraganaha Devaya Tasmai Namaha Devaya Tasmai Namaha Devaya Tasmai Namaha. Thank you, Subbu, for sharing, Sakuba, for sharing that. I think maybe what I can do is if you can please share that soft copy to everyone, we can probably just read the meaning of what the shlokas mean, and one or two shlokas we can read per week and then go through it.
Thanks, 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 Rajesh.
Yeah.
I'm getting a solid feeling of Swami P's class itself.
Actually, in Chinmaya Mission, Balvihar also, no? This is the first thing they chant, you know.
And it basically it just to give you an idea, and once Akuba can share that, you can read it. But basically, what it summarizes is, it summarizes that, how it uses the allegory of a lake with two banks, and it says that, okay, how can you cross from one bank to another bank where the river is full of a lot of crocodiles and all that stuff, and one bank is hard because a lot of let's say that you are between a devil and the deep sea. Okay, one bank is a devil, one bank is a deep sea, and you have to cross the river. How can you cross? And then you see, then it goes on to say that you can cross with a boat, in which the boatman, the person who is going to navigate the boat, is Krishna. If Krishna is the boatman, he can take you across the boat, irrespective of all the difficulties in the river. That's what it says. It's a very beautiful one. It talks about the Mahabharata war, basically. One end is a lot of all these antagonistic people. The other end is where you need to go, and then in between you have all this Duryodhana and all these guys who are alligators, blah blah, and all that. So it's a beautiful allegory, and you should read that.
It is
Okay,
called the Gita Dhyana Slokas, right?
Dhyana
Gita Dhyana
Shloka,
Shloka. It is
Mark
written
name
by
also.
Swamiji called Madhusudana Saraswati.
Madhusudana Saraswati.
Madhusudan Saraswati was, I think he was a disciple of Swami Vidyaranya,
Okay.
who wrote
Okay.
Panchadashi.
Okay.
In this fashion, in this manner, in which manner has
All right. So let's get to what we had to do today, this week. And I'm going to share my screen. We're doing 15 to 19 today. So let me chant. Arjuna uvacha, pashyami devamstava deva dehe, sarvamstatha bhuta visesha sanghan, brahmanamisham kamalasanastam, arshimscha sarvanuragamscha divyan. Arjuna uvacha, Arjuna said, Deva, O Lord, tava, thy dehe, in your body, pashyami, I see, Sarvan Devan, all the gods, Tatha Bhuta Vishesha Sanghan, as well as hosts of all various beings. Isham Brahmanam, Lord Brahma, Kamalasanastham, who is seated on the lotus, Sarvan Arshimscha, all the sages, Cha Divyan Uragan, and celestial serpents. Aneka Aneka Bahudara Vatra Netram. Pashyami Twam Sarvato Nantarupam Nantam Namadhyam Napunastavadim Pashyami Vishveshwara Vishwarupa Pashyami Twam, I see you Sarvata, everywhere Anantarupam, with countless forms Aneka Bahu Udara Vaktra Netram. Okay? Bahu is arms, Udara is abdomen, Vaktra is mouth, Netram is eyes. With many arms, abdomens, mouths, and eyes, Pashyami, I see, na tava adim, neither your beginning, na madhyam, nor the middle, na punaha antam, nor the end, Vishveshwara, O Lord of the universe, Vishwarupa, O Lord with universal form. So here he says that I see you everywhere with countless forms, with many arms, abdomens, mouths, and eyes. I see neither your beginning, nor the middle, nor the end, O Lord of the universe, O Lord with the universal form. Kiritinam gatinam chakrinam cha tejo rashim sarvato deeptimantam pashyami twam durnirikshyam samantat deepta analarkadyutim aprameyam pashyami twam, I see you, tejo rashim, as a mass of effulgence, Deeptimantam sarvataha, shining everywhere. Kiritinam, with crown. Gadinam, mace. Chakrinam cha, with wielding disc. Samantad, I see you all around. Deepta nalarka dyutim, radiant like the blazing fire and sun. Durniriksham, blinding, aprameyam, and immeasurable. I see you as a mass of effulgence shining everywhere with crown, mace, and disc. I see you all around, radiant like the blazing fire and sun, blinding and immeasurable. Tvamaksharam paramam veditavyam. Tvamasya vishvasya param nidhanam. Tvamavyaya shashvata dharma gopta. Sanatanastvam purusho matome. Tvam paramam aksharam. You are the supreme imperishable one. Veditavyam, to be known. Tvam param nidhanam. You are the ultimate support. Asya vishvasya, of this universe. Tvam avyayaha, you are the eternal. Sashvata dharma gopta, protector of the eternal dharma. Me mataha, I regard you. Tvam sanatanaha purushaha, as the eternal purusha. You are the supreme imperishable one to be known. You are the ultimate support of this universe. You are the eternal protector of the eternal dharma. I read you as the eternal purusha. The last one. Anadi madhyantam ananta viryam ananta bahum sashi surya netram pashyami tvam deepta hutasha vaktram svatejasa vishvamidam tapantam. Pashyami tvam, I see you as one anadi madhyantam, who has no beginning, middle or end. Ananta viryam, who has limitless power. Ananta bahum, who has countless arms. Sashi Surya Netram, whose eyes are the moon and the sun. Deepta Hutasha Vaktram, whose mouth is the blazing fire. Tapantam, one and who scorches idam, this universe. Swatejasa, with your radiance. I see you as one who has no beginning, middle or end, who has limitless power, who has countless arms, whose eyes are moon and the sun, whose mouth is a blazing fire, and who scorches this universe with your radiance.
Good job. Hey, so Guntax, hey, Hariom, everyone. So all these verses, 15th through 19th, they are not of Vanastubh Chanda's meter, no? It's a different meter.
There, I think it's called, I think it is Tishtubh Chanda setting. It's slightly different. There are only two Chandas, Anushtubh and the other one. Tishtubh, this
in,
one is the...
In Gita, you mean there in are Gita, two Chandas? In Gita. Gita, there are two. Okay, so this is the other one.
90% of the shlokas are Anushtubh Chandas. Wherever, you know, I mean, think Swami Paramarthananda also says this, wherever Vedavyasa wanted to emphasize something, you know, instead of bold underline, which he had no option at that point of time, he changed the meter of the shloka.
Oh, okay.
Rajesh, you and I had spoken about that last week, particularly Subbu and I, wandered into a discussion on Raga Dvesha. So I have spent some time. I have a small talk on that, which at some point today I'd like to give.
Why don't we do that first and then we can get here?
Okay. Okay.
That'll be a good continuation from the past week to this week.
So we were discussing Raga Dvesha and we were discussing its limitations. I've called this an origin Raga-Dvesha tale, which is meant to address when Raga-Dvesha comes about, why, what the purport is, and then how to overcome or move away or not be under the sway of Raga-Dvesha. So I'd like to start with ignorance that is beginningless, followed by the error, the universal error, by not knowing myself, identification with the body, mind, sense complex. So feeling isolated, small, insignificant, overwhelmed, all come about once we've identified, separated, subject-object, my identity as the body, mind, sense complex. But because we are Sat Chit Anantam, We cannot accept mortality. We are not within the boundary of time. Ignorance. Now, not ignorance as regards cosmic omniscience, but aparoksha jnanam, knowing my true identity. And of course, what we also are not able to brook is sadness. And yet, we all have experiences of wholeness, fullness, happiness, glimpses of our own natural state, the setup, and this is indeed a setup, the self reaching out to the self in the form of raga dvesha. Let's deconstruct a moment of happiness. You can call it peace, love, fullness. In that moment, any moment of happiness, the wanting self is resolved. Regardless of the apparent cause, one is not wanting the world, my body, my mind, to be different. That experience of wholeness or oneness, even merging of inner and outer, is myself. At that moment, samsara, becoming, is at a standstill. Every moment of happiness is exactly this dissection. But unrecognized, the moment is fleeting, and thus likes and dislikes propel us. But just as time as relative, I love when Swami Dayananda talks about stand on a hot plate for 10 seconds and you will see the time does not move. Likes and dislikes are constantly changing and subject to time, place, society. We are all marble sannyasis. So if any of you played marbles as a child, or I played with Play-Doh a lot, or jacks, we have no need to do those things and no loss in not doing, because all of us are sannyasis as regards that particular raga. As we conceptualize ourselves within the fog of raga dvesha, so we see others. In other words, if they seem to have similar values in terms of likes and dislikes, we feel a kinship. If they're different or opposite, a disdain or separateness. What is the purport of raga dvesha? Why are we saddled with raga dvesha? Because if we're paying attention, it should lead to discontent with the fleeting nature of the moments of joy. It should lead to Viagra, not Viagra, Vairagya, dispassion, which leads to vichara, inquiry. Where? How to satisfy a natural and unstoppable urge? Falls within the four purusharthas, artha, kama, dharma, moksha. Artha, security, also is part of the hard wiring of anything alive, wants to stay alive, and wants to procreate. Now, as humans, we overlay with raga dveshas, but it stands on its own, actually. And when I say overlay, for example, we don't just want an apartment, we may want a mansion. We might not just want clothes, we want designer threads. So what does one really want? At the essence, what is the want that drives all other wants? It's the want to be free of wants. From the sense of lack alone, self-ignorance, all desires arise. Desires become binding because I think their fulfillment is the basis for some kind of satisfaction for myself. The problem is ignorance. The solution can only be knowledge. Brahman is Satyam, and the whole world, Jagat, is Mithya. This means that the body, mind, and senses are also Mithya. And the Jiva, which is other than the physical body, mind, and senses, which is Atma, is Brahman. Therefore, Jiva is non-separate from Brahman, which means that I am everything. There is no difference caused by ignorance. Ignorance being removed, there is only awareness. The Atma of Ishvara and the Atma of the Jiva is one and the same Atma, whose Swarupa is awareness. That talk which I shared by Swamiji on awareness, that which you cannot negate. This awareness, this Atma alone, is self-existent, the whole, which is Ishvara, which is the Jiva. In chapter 6, and I've been spending a lot of time on chapter 6 meditation in the Bhagavad Gita, speaking of meditation, Krishna says, you cannot break the hold of raga dvesha without seeing oneself differently as the whole, or in knowing there is only me as Parameshwara. In other words, because we see ourselves literally as the dukkhi, as the sukhi, how can you leave oneself? And that very person has created that status. Only in finding one's true identity can the false be seen as false. And once that occurs, raga dvesha's hold or sway has no power to propel. They may fade away or remain as preferences, but there is no power to bind. Ariel.
Beautiful, Rick. So, Rick, did you actually write this thing down?
I tend to make notes if I'm going to talk about something. It's not every word for word, but I want to make sure I cover the topic as I am intending to do. You all know I speak spontaneously, but when I have something I want to talk about, I do default to an outline.
Beautiful.
So, Subbu, do we come to some agreement here?
I actually wanted to reflect on what you've been saying, Rick. Is it possible that you can share it? Maybe I'll go through it a bit more. Yeah. I did get the gist of what you're trying to say, but I would like to reflect on it a little bit more. Yeah.
Maybe when this week's session, we can break it out just, you know, by itself too.
Sure.
Whoever.
Thank you. That. Thank you for this, Rick. Yeah.
I wanted to respond. And also, you made me want to think about in a deeper way both the scope and the limitation of raga dvesha. And Krishna is so insistent in chapter 6 that you have to turn away, that you cannot break the binding unless you can see yourself outside of it. And once you see yourself outside of it, it has no longer any power to trap. And that's a beautiful, that was helpful for me.
So I was listening to Swami P's commentary on some of these shlokas. His take on Vishwarupa is completely
very different.
He's saying if you're thinking that the Vishwarupam was some form that Arjuna was able to see, then you lost the whole plot, right? Vishwarupam is literally seeing Bhagavan in the universe, everywhere, always, right? So, and he says all these raga, dvesha, kama, krodha, ahamkar, and mamkar, all these are the blinders that cover the divya chakshu or the divine vision. And once we are ready, we can see the Vishwarupam in the universe itself. It is not that something has to appear before you, right? And he says, when we hear stories about gods appearing before people in Puranas, like Rama appearing before Shabari, or Krishna appearing before Meera, etc., they have gone through a tremendous tapas or exercise of cleansing themselves, and they have been focusing on that form. That is why that form appears before them. But Vishwarupam is not any particular form. It is the universe itself, is what Swami P says. So I thought that was pretty profound. And he goes on to say that when Rama appeared before Ravana, Ravana did not have any impact, right? Ravana You know, even his attitude towards God did not change. But when Rama appeared before Shabari, she had such a wonderful experience, and that is because her attitude towards the same God was different, and she had gone through this exercise of cleansing herself and preparing herself to see Rama. So yeah, that's what Swami Peace talk you know, is based on. So I thought I'll share that.
So if I understand what you're saying, he's taking it out of an experience and putting it more as an understanding.
True.
Yes. Yes.
So he says understanding is twofold, you know. One is a physical understanding, the other one is the attitudinal appreciation of the object in hand. So for example, he gives this example of Beatles, right? So somebody gives you a broken down guitar, you know, you would probably value it for a few hundred rupees, right? But then somebody just gives a perspective to you, which is slightly different, saying that, hey, this was something that was used by George Harrison. Then suddenly the value multiplies, you know, multifold, right? So you're seeing the same object, but you're actually having a different perspective to what you're seeing now, okay? Because there has been an additional understanding that now God is just not, you know, God there, but, you know, whatever you see around you, right? So that's the thing that he brings up, saying that, you know, the physical appreciation comes immediately, but to get the attitudinal aspiration, which is what he says, you know, is bhakti, right? For you to be able to appreciate that additional value, you know, you need to see it in a different perspective. And he says, this is what the Divya Chakshu is all about. What is this Divya Chakshu appreciation of having an attitudinal change is free of ahamkara and mamakara, right? So when you're free of ahamkara and mamakara, the mind is completely clear and you're able to see a better appreciation of things and seeing the God as the Vishwarupa. Am I right, Uday? I mean, yeah.
Perfect, perfect. Yeah, you summed it up very well. Yep.
And along those lines, I think Swami Dayananda always spoke about a Jivan Mukta as somebody who has no filters and able to see objectively because there's no need to shade.
What is interesting with Swami P is that I've heard a commentary like this, which describes a Vishwarupa as not a physical huge form, but a shift in, you know, the perspective that one is actually looking at things, right? I've never seen this in many commentaries. I've read 3-4 other commentaries, but nobody has said it like this. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting too.
Yeah.
It makes it more attainable too.
Yeah.
It makes it something available to everyone.
Exactly. That's the other point, you know, that it's not just, so Divya Chakshu is not something that was given, you know, it is something that can also be acquired if you were to free your mind from ahamkara and mamakara, and then whatever you see, you appreciate as a, you know, an aspect of God. Yeah. So if you look at your hand, it is God. If you look at your body, it is God. If you look at somebody else, it is God. If you look at a table, chair, everything is the material cause is the same as the principal cause. So as a result of which, you know, you see God in everything. Yeah.
And so, one point I just remembered, he says how Arjuna got Divya Chakshu was through a miracle of the Lord, right? And acquisition of the Divya Chakshu in such a miracle sort of a way, it won't be permanent. It will be temporary, right? That's why Arjuna was seeing the Vishwarupam for a period of time and then it switched back to the normal, this thing, right? But if you go the route of bhakti, of penance and sacrifice and practice of bhakti all through your life and then attain the vision like how these seers have attained, then it is a permanent shift in your reality, is what Swami P says, right, Subhu?
That correct, also... correct.
That was an interesting view from Paramatmananda Swami P. But I'm kind of reflecting on what you said, right? I think to me it's a little bit of a cause and effect, right? Mm. Because to get an experience that everything is Bhagwan, there needs to be a, sometimes there's a strong experience is needed, right? Otherwise, just intellectually transcending that would be difficult, right? It'd still be abstract as a concept. So, so maybe there was an experience, and that experience, when it distilled, it became an understanding, or it was able to relate to the idea that everything is Bhagwan, right? Otherwise, everything is Bhagwan, we are one. I mean, that's the very first shloka, right? The very first chapter he talks about it, right? Then he doesn't need the 18 chapters because this is such a difficult bridge to cross from where we are. So I think that's kind of how I reflect on it. I think the experience would have helped him to get closer to that understanding, you know?
Absolutely. That's why I reflect on it. No, that's true. What he says is, it is not a permanent switch.
It's not a permanent switch, right? But it's like you're reading a menu about something and it gives you a taste of it.
Taste
is not always on the tongue, right? Because your you know, memories still come back and needs more cleansing. Agree.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, pick the same thread, right? So here is how I have always interpreted this, right? And, the most important verse for me in this chapter is the shloka which says that I'm going to give you this Divya Chakshu, the divine eye, by which you can look at my, you know, universal form, right? So I've read, I don't remember, I think it was probably Swami Paramarthananda and maybe Swami Gurupadananda as well. And they say very clearly that, you know, giving that Divya Chakshu means exactly removing all those veils of ignorance that progressively keep on covering and layering it in such a way that it's completely blocked. The divine vision of a person is blocked. And actually, you know, we can do this thought experiment by ourselves at an intellectual level, let's say, okay, not necessarily at an experiential level, at an intellectual level. You know, when you sit down for meditation at one day or the other, just for the moment, if you make a resolution, okay, saying that, you know, I don't think I'm this body, okay, then you make your reservation, go through that entire Nirvana Shatakam and say that, okay, I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm not this thoughts, I'm not this likes, desires. When you repeat that mentally, and then you say, okay, now who am I? Then it's going to be very difficult for you to peg yourself saying that this is this person in this body, or this is this person with this hand, legs, nothing. Then you will come to a point where you'll not be able to express who you are. Okay. And it doesn't have to be an experience, but it can theoretically work for each one of us. That's what I'm trying to say. And that at that point of time, temporarily, when you remove that ignorance, when you remove that likes and dislikes, when you remove that, you know, the identity what you have assumed for yourself, you can actually see the Vishwarupa. Temporarily. You should please try it.
Jay.
Yeah, no, I kind of also heard Swami P, and I think the key message that I took away was that as humans, our natural inclination is to look at everything in a form, right? And as like, you know, therefore, you know, the whole description of multiple eyes and hands and heads is something at a certain level it resonates, and, you know, B.R. Chopra in some ways kind of perpetuated it. But what Swami P actually resonates quite well, because, you know, the whole idea of the way we think about Vedanta or how we learn Vedanta is that there is no form, right? And that therefore the focus, I think, is to try and get people to appreciate Aneka Rupa Brahman. So moving from a form, which is Eka Rupa, which is the idol, for example, or any such thing, to saying that everything in the world is Brahman, so Aneka Rupa Brahman. And then he also, I think in one of his earlier lectures, talks about the fact that Divya Chakshu is nothing but a pure mind, which in effect, as Rick and others were talking about, is free from raga dvesha and amkara mamakara, etc., as Uday described. So I think that description is quite valid. And I think he also talks about a word that I quite sort of like, that it's all about the bhavana. And he uses the example of prasadam, where if you had an ordinary apple, it would be any apple. But if you kind of, you know, put it through the aarti or puja, it becomes prasad, right? And so that all comes not because the apple is changed, but there is a element of bhavana, and we could describe that as an attitude or whatever. But ultimately, that is the driver. And so the challenge in a way is to not just look at the prasad as prasad, but everything that's out there as the vibhuti of Bhagavan, right? So I think all of that sort of made sense to me, and it's easier to relate to it than look at one single person as such as Vishwarupa. The one thing that I sort of reflected on, and I'm still sort of trying to get my head around, is if you get rid of all these raga dvesha and the small eye, then what is the difference then between Vishwarupa and the ultimate enlightenment, if you know what I mean?
No difference.
Because if you kind of cross that horizon where, all of this is, you've got this divine eye and Divya Chakshu and all these Shadripus are gone, then shouldn't you be already at enlightenment? So, but we also know that there are three steps. So there's Eka Rupa, Aneka Rupa, and then going to Arupa, which is the Nirguna Brahman. So that transition between Vishwarupa and Nirguna is where I kind of am still kind of thinking about, and I don't fully sort of appreciate, what are those two steps.
Maybe that'll come later, Ajay. I think, see, what I took from this, just to add for to what you have said just now, I think first he brings in the concept of attitudinal change, right? That is, and he says that attitudinal change to value a guitar for millions and not just hundreds will happen only from knowledge and understanding. Yeah. You need to know somebody called George Harrison. You need to know what he's done. You need to appreciate what he's, contributed, et cetera, et cetera. So the attitudinal change will only happen through knowledge and understanding. That's the first point he's making. The second thing he says is when you take that appreciation, right, that everything around is the Lord himself, the second inference he's making is that I am nothing, right? So everything is God. I look at my hand, I look at my body, I look at outside, I look at inside. He says, if you look inside, it is Aham Brahmasmi. If you look outside, it is Tatvamasi, right? So anything and everything is God. Then what are you? You are nothing. And when you come to this point of inference, because of the attitudinal change and the knowledge and understanding that you have got, then what happens is it becomes, when you take up this attitude of I am nothing, then there is a question of, there is an element of surrender, right? And at the same time, when you know you're nothing, there is nothing belongs to you. So there is no mamakara and you cannot be proud of anything. And there is no ahamkara, right? So when nothing belongs to you and nothing, really is connected to you, then you are free of ahamkara and mamakara. And therefore, you develop that Divya Chakshu to be able to see and appreciate Vishwarupa. I think that's the kind of logic I took from you know, his notes, you know.
No, I get that. And yeah. I think you're right. I mean, there is a possibly another step, because in my mind, I have kind of got this kind of perception, yeah. which perhaps is not.
Yeah, and I think the only difference, I think, Ajay, is, you know, from Nirguna to from Saguna to Nirguna, I think that step is coming later. I have not done the full Gita, yeah, so I don't know. I can't talk about it. But yeah. Till this point, what I understood was there is a physical form from where he becomes one, becomes many, and then finally maybe many becomes one again. I don't know how it is going to go, but maybe those are for the later chapters. Yeah,
possibly, because I mean, I always,
the only shift is that Saguna Nirguna shift is what I think is going to come, is my sense. You know,
possibly, because, you know, I always thought that, you know, once you're done with sort of Raga Dvesha and Ahamkara and Vairagya, and you achieve like the highest degree of Vairagyam, then you're done, right?
Yeah.
But it feels like there is probably one more step. And
as you were
saying, I was thinking about it, that, you know, there is this whole sort of thing about there is only God, which is probably this step, right? Yeah. And the next step is probably what, again, I think Swami's SPG kind of talks a lot about this. There is only God, to God only is, right? So that might be that last step. So fair enough. Got it.
So Ajay, you might want to go back and revisit Rajavidya Rajagopya Yoga chapter at this stage.
Any reference, Rajesh? Why are you saying that?
No, going from Saguna to Nirguna. So, okay, the way that Rajavidya Rajagopya Yoga will tie up to Ajay's question is very, very useful.
Mastani Sarvabhutani, that 4, 5, 6.
Anyway, I see three hands raised. Sakuba.
Yeah, so I have a couple of questions actually. So one is, you know, so we all have those fleeting moments where we are able to see, you know, God everywhere around us. But of course it doesn't stay, you know, at all times actually. So just want to understand from the rest of us here, like, to what extent are you able to see that? And I mean, in terms of percentage or in terms of whatever, you know, metric you may like to use. And second question is, so how do you, I mean, I'm just looking for some practical tips, you know, in terms of how do you stay in that state? Now, I heard Rajesh talking about, you know, contemplating on Nirvana Chaitanya. So that's a good suggestion. Other than that, you know, people can share a few methods that they follow through which they're able to stay in that state for a longer period. Otherwise, we all get those fleeting moments, definitely, right? I mean, we do see especially in both sentient as well as in inert beings, we are able to see God, but doesn't stay there always.
Saku, if I may just, you know, help in this, at least I can tell you what probably I try to do, although I'm definitely not there yet. But the fact is, I think to be constantly aware that everything around you is God. I think if you just have that point with you and be aware of it as much as you can, and whenever there is a fleeting moment that, you know, you probably burst into a sign of either, you know, raga, dvesha, anger, you know, you sort of get irritated, etc., etc., I think quickly try and get back to that space through the awareness that, you know, God is everything, you know, and then maybe reflect a little bit to figure out, you know, what is God trying to give me here as a message? Let's say somebody shouted at you, or you're getting angry with somebody. I think the quick thing is to, okay, fine, you may have shouted, you may have reacted as a human, but very quickly to get back to the state and say, hey, why did this happen in the first place? And is there somewhere I could have done something different to be able to prevent it? If I truly appreciate that he or she is God, or, you know, the person whom I'm speaking to is a reflection of the divinity. I think to be in constant awareness and do it is the way forward, which I think has, you know, something I'm trying to put in place. But maybe somebody else can add to this. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, if I can say to that, I think there's much merit in that. But sometimes we don't go through the garbage, we just throw it out. And what I mean by that is, in terms of the reaction, which is the content of my mind, if I just step back and see I am the one who knows the content, I am not the reaction, I am not the response, I am awareness. That's a shortcut, if you will. Not that the going through the reactions isn't important, but the truth of the matter is I am always free. I am never what I am aware of. So I would say that is a way of quickly getting back, stepping back to my own sahaj samadhi, if you will. The other thing I would say is, for me, I did a lot of meditation on there is only you, Lord. There is no me. There is no me apart from thee. There is only thee, and everything is only thee. And it's very joyful. And I think it's very impactful. And it's not hard to do. You could just sit down, meditate, or just as you see something beautiful, you just, yeah, again, it's the vibhutis. Oh, it's you, Lord. It's all you, Lord. And all my reactions too. I can't take credit for anything. There is no me to hoist the flag about, or you know, there's just thee, Lord. And there's not a lot to have to step between that. And if we're gonna say Saguna Brahman, in the sense that all that appears is Ishwara, well, that in which it appears is Brahman. And that is the awareness that I do nothing to achieve, and I cannot be other than. I don't think we give enough credit. We don't step back enough just to see. I am always aware. There is no effort in being aware. And Krishna does keep pounding throughout the Gita. This is not hard. This is simple. This is available to you. And at some point, we have to take him at his word.
I mean, what you say, Rick, actually... You know, you're right. I mean, if you take a step back and pause and reflect, that is a wonderful way of thinking about it, that, you know, I'm just awareness. But the fact remains that in the transactional world, I am what I am, right? And that's kind of, in some ways, the transactional reality. And one of the things which I, again, listening to Swami P, which sort of was quite... eye-opening in a way. I mean, it's nothing new, but when you think about it, it's quite interesting, is that he talks about the insignificance of us as jivas. And he puts that into perspective by, you know, comparing the galaxy that we are in, which is the Milky Way, I don't know where he takes it from. Apparently it's something which I'm sure we can find on the internet. But he says if you take a bowl of dust, like a meter in diameter, for example. And he says the Milky Way galaxy is a speck of dust in that big bowl of whatever dust, right? And he says in that speck of dust, we're like an insignificant solar system, and Earth is an insignificant planet, and, you know, we're like absolutely irrelevant, if you will, right? And I think just to me, what it did was to say, we can have an ego as big as anything we think, you know, we would like it to be. But the fact remains that we are like just irrelevant, insignificant, whatever adjective you want to use, right? And I think that sort of, in some ways, does kind of bring into perspective that let's not kind of get ahead of ourselves kind of thing. Right. And so you're right. I mean, I think if you look at it from the Nirguna lens, you're absolutely correct. Think about it as awareness and say, why are you kind of sweating over all of this? On the other hand, you kind of say, look, I can sweat over it, and I might think I'm like this big sort of person or whatever else, right? The fact remains that, you know, we're like, we don't matter beyond a point.
I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think they're exclusionary.
They're not.
We can truly do both, and we have to do the work. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. I purposely chose, after studying in college Hinduism and Buddhism, my feeling was I had a kind of intellectual grasp, but I didn't have an understanding beyond that. And I wanted it to be deeper. And I spent the next 10 years working as a surgical technician assisting in surgery, because my thought was, if I put myself having to deal with death constantly, my meditation will get better. And it did.
No, absolutely, Eric. And you're right. I mean, they are not exclusionary. I mean, both of them can be looked at, you know, together.
So, if I may add here, I think it's an excellent discussion. I think, as you pointed out, they're not exclusionary, but it's almost like a cycle. One helps the other, and the other helps, like, it's mental purification is what you're saying, one part of it, right? And that leads to the better understanding of being able to step back and look at these things in a different way, and that I am awareness, right? To be able to get there, you need a level of mental purification, right? A certain amount of mental purity needs to be there to get that. But that thinking eventually also causes mental purity, right? Just the fact of looking at it as awareness gives you mental purity also. So it's a cycle, right? And it's a question of where you enter that cycle, and then kind of both are needed, right? So yet another perspective to Satya's question. I'm just looking at it from a yogic lens right here, is around looking at it from guna perspective, right? So in transactional world, when we do feel agitated, frustrated, or wanting something badly, or getting rid of something badly, raga dvesha, right? We are being driven by rajas and tamas, right? I mean, at that point. And you want to back up to more predominance of sattva. That's one way of saying it. The other way of saying it is, if you look at our chariot analogy of the sense organs being the five horses, we are being driven by that. We want to hold back and come back towards the passenger, right? It's so to speak. You want the center to be closer to the passenger and not towards the sense organs, right? So even in that sense, you're kind of backing up to sattva more compared to and rajas and tamas, right? So now if you look at it in daily situations, what would that be to back up to sattva predominance, right? That would be about, you know, whether it's right speech, whether it's ahimsa, or all of the yamas and niyamas that you apply and hold it very, very tight, or just the values that are going to be prescribed in the other chapters of Gita that's upcoming, you hold that tight as the anchor. And then you, no matter the situation, you kind of hold on to that sattva and be more sattva predominant and not be driven by rajas, right, to react, or tamas to not react and to be lethargic, right? So you kind of hold that sattva, right? By doing that, your center point is closer to the passenger in that analogy, rather than being driven by the horses, right? When we do that, this thinking of I am awareness becomes more easy and more natural. So then it's a cyclical process that we are part of this nice upward cycle, right? So then the practical to me is to maintain that sattva. And to go towards that, right? Make a choice based on that. That's how I see it.
Shrini, good comment, Kishore. I like the approach.
Yeah. Okay. I have a very basic question. So, Arjuna went through three kinds of emotions when he saw the Vishwarupa Darshan, which is, the wonderment of fear and finally the surrender. So that is, does it mean that, it is applicable for us also once, we get into this Divya Chakshu, either through, divine grace or through intense bhakti, we will also, go through these three stages of, transformation. Like, first you will have the wonderment, then fear, and then surrender. Is it for us, or is it only the expression which happened to Arjuna? Is my question, because everywhere whatever is being related to Arjuna is actually directly related to us also. So in this case, my question is very basic. So do we also have to understand this, that once we get this, we will have these three basic emotions which we have to go through, is my question.
Shridi, can I suggest one thing? Can we just pause your question, because let's complete if there are any more reflections on what Sakuba's question was.
Okay,
and then understood. We can get to what you're talking, because that's a, I feel, a slightly different topic than what Sakuba asked.
Okay, fine.
Can you say what was Sakuba's question? Sorry, I joined late, so would like to know.
No, I was just asking, so we all have fleeting moments of able to see God everywhere in both sentient as well as things. I just wanted to know, from the team here, how do we stay in that? What do you do to stay in that kind of a moment? So Guntax talked about, contemplating on Nirvana Shatakam. Then you heard what Kishore talked about, Rick and Subbu also shared. So do you have anything?
So Sakuba, the technique that helped me a lot, there are two frameworks from what I understand. Is one is, I think what Rick and everybody else been saying is, when it comes mentally, try to give a gap, right? But some of the, for example, somebody is a big lover of food, right? The will break. Okay, at some point, it's very difficult when there's a hot plate of yummy food before you and you're trying to mentally push it back. Some people can do it. Some people, the will break and you'll eat, right? As an example I'm giving. A lot of the push and pulls is coming, from that type of behavior. There's a very powerful technique I've come across that my guru taught him from Shiva Agama that breaks, that looks into why the push and pull comes, right? Because there's a blood flow when you see a food into your tongue and, it pulls you, right? It works at the root cause of why that blood flow happens, right? From a very fundamental level. And I found it's a technique called Purnatva from Shiva Agama. And that is what I find personally helped me hugely to dissolve some of this reactionary capabilities, right? Because it attacks not your mental strength or mental understanding, but goes one level and says, at the core level, why you react in a certain way and try to dissolve that identity itself.
What is the technique?
That's kind of helped me the most. It's just as a thing. Yeah.
Wait, Mukul, what is the technique itself? I'm missing what you're actually doing.
It's actually take a little bit of time. I can send you a link to that video in the group if anybody's interested. It's from Shiva Agama. It's kind of an elaborate process you go through, kind of understanding the why
Mukul,
certain
reactions. I think it's okay if you can take maybe a couple of minutes to summarize that before you send it.
It's not going to be 2 minutes. It's going to take a bit. That's what I'm saying. So, but then if you want, we can
send
talk
it
off.
To me.
I don't want
to
hijack this class for that. I'll send you the link, and if anybody wants, a group of you wants, I can talk about it. It'll take about 30, 35 minutes to kind of give a reasonably good outline to it. Otherwise, we cannot do justice in 2 minutes to that.
Okay, then let's do it as follows. Because you send that reading material, and maybe next week we can spend 15, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, whatever, and then we can walk. You can help us walk through that.
Sure, yeah, I can do that, yeah. And that's what helped me the most, Satya.
Yeah, I'll tell you the reason why I want to go there slightly more deeper into it, right? Because, see, at the end of the day, this satsang is not for improving the theoretical knowledge. The theoretical knowledge is always there from reading or listening to what different Swamiji's that we follow says. It's about how each one of us are able to implement that in our lives. That is more relevant for each one of us, because we have to learn from each other and figure out how to make it happen in our own lives.
Understood.
I hope all of you are okay with that approach.
No, yeah, absolutely fine. Yeah,
yeah, well said, Guntax. So Mukul, I look forward to that video, what you're saying. But somehow, all of us are coming back to, that we are not able to see God because there is a, a raga dvesha in that. I somehow not been able to fully kind of agree to that. And that's where I have a challenge in, maybe last time also I talked about this, and this time also I'm continuing with this, a similar kind of a question, that I don't have, I think with many of the things that I've heard, it's not, I'm not, I don't think it is the Raga Dvesha that stops me from seeing God in Arvishwarupa, in everything around me. So I somehow I'm not able to accept that premise. So I think
it's not Raga Dvesha, right? Satya, that's my point, right? It's not just that those two words, but what I broadly understand is, like, I have a mamakara, right? Whom I believe inside what it is, right? It's not as much as Raga Dvesha, maybe a playing role into it, but in the science of, the one that the Shiva Agama talks about, is the identity I have for myself, right? I'm good at this, I'm bad at that, right? If you look at that identity is because of some memories, right? If you look at it, your mom might have told you something when you're like 3 years old, right? You're good, and you might have made a mistake, and then you think, oh, I'm bad at this, right? I'm good at this. I'm ugly. I'm beautiful, right? All of those identities, right, or ideas that we carry about ourselves are based on memories, right? Some memories are from this birth. Some memories can also come from the previous birth, which are unexplainable, right? So that's how this technique attacks. And the Agama talks about identifying those memories and dissolving it, right? Dissolving the power it has on us. So that, when we start responding or reacting, that power of that memory on the reaction is not there. It's not as much as Raga Dvesha. It just is how you react to a situation. You see something outside, you react from memories, right? Lens of memories. And how do you clean that? Almost like, you have a colored glass, splintered glass, how you keep on cleaning it, so that the reality comes as it is put in front of you. That's kind of how this, that's what this technique goes, and that's what really helped, that perspective what personally helped me as in this journey, continues to help me.
Thank you, Mukul.
So I'd also like to approach this from the experience question that keeps coming up again and again and again. Experience in itself is dumb. Experience has to be understood or assimilated. Take an alcoholic. Who has more experience with drinking than an alcoholic? But what does an alcoholic understand about the addiction and about the interwoven quality of alcohol, its role in his life? Well, in a similar way, there's a lot of trash talk about how it's only intellectual, your understanding. All understanding is intellectual about subject-object. Anything we come to know about is intellectual. There's no spleen knowledge. There's no stomach knowledge. It's all of the mind / intellect. So that's not something we should put down. And the only time it's different is self-knowledge. And there's still a vritti that points out the knowledge. It's just in self-knowledge, the self recognizes the self. That's why you're never going to experience the self. You're never going to grasp the self. It's like trying to catch moving water with your hand. You cannot do it. You can't become who you already are. Okay, which again takes me back to, and at least for me in meditation, for years and years, meditating was a matter of letting the mind go wherever it wants and see myself as not, learning not to pursue it, learning just to let it rise and fall. It's kind of like seeing the space between two thoughts. The more you can see that, and also recognizing that thoughts are nothing but awareness. We're not trapped in memories. We're not trapped in past lives. That's really a disservice. I'm not saying those things aren't true, but the opportunity to be realized in this lifetime is real and present and now. And all the teachers that we deal with will say that. I'm not saying anything they don't say ceaselessly. So what does it mean? It means we have to embrace who we are and let everything else just fall away, because we know it's not true to our nature. And again, the idea that we're going to get to an experience, that's why Swami Dayananda continually talks about anantam instead of bliss, because all experiences, even nirvikalpa samadhi, have a beginning and an end. So for 15 minutes, I'm eternal. That's not what we're after. That's not the truth of who we are. They're pointers, not to negate them. They're all pointers, but ultimately it's jnanam. And to me, whether it's jnanam or bhakti, they become the same. Whether I know there is no second or I know there's only the Lord, those are not two understandings.
Just one said, more affliction.
That's beautiful. And Sakuba, I think looks like there are some good pointers in here. If anyone wants to conclude on this particular topic for today, and then we can go to Srini's question.
I just had one reflection. You know, I think to be able to appreciate something outside of you, I think it is important for you to appreciate, you know, and be at peace with yourself first, you know. I think, so to me, I think we will be able to understand and appreciate this Vishwarupa if we are once, you know, happy with ourselves and at peace with ourselves, right? And whatever it takes to gain that, you know, tranquility and equanimity, etc., whatever techniques are there, be it meditation or, you know, whatever Mukund spoke about, we are able to then withdraw ourselves the way Kishore spoke. You know, when we are in tune with that, I think then we are able to appreciate things in a better light, what is outside of us. I mean, it's just a reflection, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Sakuba, Swami P also says it should be a natural process rather than a suppression. So your question understood that your question is this, na, that without going beyond raga dvesha, how can I see God? Or is it possible to see God even with having raga dvesha? Is that your question?
Yes.
See, you are saying today. Today I have raga dvesha, which means that I am not able to see God. I know the real God. So, right. What is the stepping stone?
I don't think that is the thing. So, I mean, of course, we as mortals, you know, we will. I mean, we do have raga dvesha. So, I was trying to ask, you know, that even when you don't have raga dvesha, during a particular time or during whatever it is, So do you see everything at that point of time, you know, do you see everything as God?
Okay.
So, and if not, how do we cultivate that? I think we've got a lot of pointers, actually. I think it's good to contemplate on each one.
Understood.
In fact, in one of the lectures, I remember, they say that, you know, to be able to understand Vishwarupam, I think one way to get started is, whenever you see something very beautiful, you relate it to the vibhuti of the Lord, right? It could be a wonderful sunrise. It could be a sunset. It could be the stars in the sky. It could be, the trek that you're taking. You're enjoying the moment. You're appreciating the moment. And you start to see the vibhuti of the Lord and saying that this is His glory, okay? Then you extend it to anything that you see amongst your friends and peers and family. Somebody is a great singer, right? You may be a singer yourself, but somebody has done a fabulous job in the way he's presented himself in terms of the understand that there is divinity and there is vibhuti of the Lord playing out, right? And if you are consistently be able to see and appreciate all the goodness around you and attribute it to the vibhuti of the Lord, then you would try to do it even with your best friend and your best competitor. You know, that is where you, if you were to do it, then what happens is that the barrier of raga dvesha just disappears, right? Because you're not only appreciating the singing of somebody who is your friend and best friend who's doing a fantastic performance, but you're also able to appreciate the same beauty of singing in somebody else who's probably been your competitor all through your life, right? So there, I think, is where, you know, if you're able to keep that principle in check, then, you know, Raga Dvesha automatically starts to go away is, you know, my take. Yeah.
I think, Subhu, you said it well. Maybe there's one more step in there, which is where I think maybe we're all heading to, is to say that, okay, it's not appreciate the beauty in the other person singing or other person's cooking or whatever. You say that person who's singing is no one else other than me. When you get to that point, that's a constant practice.
Fair enough, yeah.
Then summer is setting in, and I recall one of the discussions what we had about mangoes here long back, where people living in India, you know, we were saying that, okay, hey, you know, we're not getting mangoes, good mangoes here in the US. And somebody, I think it was VP or Ajay, I don't recall, who mentioned saying that, you know, a lot of good mangoes are coming in here now. And then I think it was Alpana who commented saying that, okay, yeah, you know, just it's okay. If you're eating the mangoes, that's fine. You know, we are all satisfied. That kind of an attitude, once we start developing, it's
brilliant.
It becomes much more easier to say, okay, you're getting that. And I think, Sukuba, that's a constant practice that one we have to do it consciously. First, initially, it's like shifting gears in a geared car. You know, when you start driving a car, shifting gears is very hard initially because you're doing it consciously. But after some time, it becomes totally, totally subconscious that you can be able to shift gears, talk on the phone, and still change lanes and still not meet with an accident.
I think Srini had a question. Yeah.
Just one more on this Raga Dvesha business. I didn't bring it up to throw it under the bus. Everyone can do this in any moment of successful, either gaining or being freed of. Whatever the Raga Dvesha is, in the moment of fulfillment, notice what happens. In that, it's like a sunset. You ever watch an amazing sunset and you close your eyes? What are you doing closing your eyes? You're watching the sunset. And Swami Dayananda says the eyes close of themselves because they're no longer needed. They took you to the experience, but what you want to experience, that beauty inside, but really in that moment, inside and outside go away. That is the whole. We all experience the whole. We are not separated from the experience of the whole. In any moment of happiness or joy or peace or love, you are the whole. You are experiencing yourself. Notice that. Try to notice all of us as we live our lives and have these, whether it's getting a position at work that one wanted, whether it's, you know, it's Valentine's Day and you bring something for your beloved and she has the response you were hoping to get, whatever it is, in a meal, a meal that you've really looked forward to. Maybe it's your favorite meal from when you were a kid. It doesn't matter at all, because in any of them, the quote unquote factors fall away, because the joy is always only of myself. And if you see that, if you ramp up and see that, Raga Dvesha is not a problem. It's not getting in the way. Nothing's getting in the way. We are always who we are. But those are great moments to see it. That's pretty practical.
Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, it is.
So I don't know, Sukuba, if you are, you know, I'm just trying to sort of look at it from, maybe I'm thinking a few things and maybe this might help you. But, you know, one of the challenges that I often face is that I struggle with two things. One is, how do I kind of see somebody who has done wrong to either me or I believe is not a good person, irrespective of whether I know that person or not, right? And how do I look at that? You know, how do I reconcile with this whole Vishwa Rupa and the fact that somebody is doing wrong, somebody is, you know, has some evil sort of thoughts or whatever, right? So that's one part. And then the other one is around, we see so much, you know, you said, you know, with the sun, we're reverential automatically, or if a beautiful mountain or river or the usual vibhutis that Bhagwan talks about in chapter 10, we're kind of naturally kind of aligned to it, but not with everything else that we see in the world, which could be dirty, filthy, whatever else, right? And how do I see that as Vishwarupa? And there are two sort of things which I try and sort of reflect on and feel and, you know, give myself comfort. I think the first one is when somebody does something wrong, I attribute it to two. I mean, I kind of try and find comfort in two things. One is that I don't know the circumstances of that person, and therefore I should not sit in judgment of what that person is doing, because I only know the surface, or at least what I perceive. Right. So I'm willing to give the benefit of doubt to the other person, and that I don't want to judge that person on the basis of what I know, because I don't know a lot of stuff. Right. And then the other part, of course, is around the karma part, which is that we all have evil wrongdoings in our own sort of ways. We all know it. We don't need to talk about it, but we all know it within ourselves. And so that's probably a result of the karma cycle. And that's kind of playing itself out. So let the sort of law of karma sort of take shape and keep moving. And so you kind of extract yourself from that sort of negativity and say, this will sort itself out. And then the third part is that when we talk about, you know, what we don't like, or what our eyes don't like, or, you know, our sense organs don't like in the world around us, which is effectively nature sort of getting back at us to say that that's probably a result of what I call the collective karma, where we're all sort of doing harm to the environment, for example, and nature is basically balancing itself out. And so that is also part of the natural process of evolution. And so the upshot of all of this is that I'm trying not to let my sort of views and feelings and thoughts kind of drive my thinking, but I'm trying to put myself in a limited way as possible into the other person's shoes and say, this is fine, this will play out. And I don't want to make that as a negative point for the other person, how much ever in my limited wisdom that person might be wrong, but that person is right in his own, in his or her own way, and I should not therefore try and make a judgment. So it's complicated, but you know, the fact remains that I think the biggest issue that I have struggled with is that why is there so much evil in the world, right? And then you kind of say, no, it's not evil. It's basically the nature and the karma kind of balancing the universe out, and it will happen. And this is the nature of the law, the universal law, and therefore let it just play out. I don't know whether I made sense, but it's just
very nice.
You know, both the way, I mean, the way you put both the problem statements as well as how you are handling, I think. Very good. Thank you.
Just one thing I would like to add, Ajay. I think the third part you could probably also look at is send positive vibes back to the person who's doing wrong to you, if that is a possibility.
Mm.
And you will see transformation happening. Trust me on that.
All right. Anyone else on this topic? Any other insights? Okay, we got 8 more minutes. Srini, would you like to repeat your question once again?
No, my question is very simple. See, Arjuna goes through, you know, 3 kinds of emotions. One is wonderment, the other is fear, and later surrender. So, if we understand God, or if we are going to get the Divya Chakshu, we are also going to face the same 3 emotions, is the question. So, you know, how to deal with these emotions, or, you know, is this what going to happen? Suppose we also, you know, happen to see the Vishwarupa Darshan, is the question. Or is it, you know, related only to Arjuna? Because everywhere the emotions are related to us. What Arjuna is doing is only a phase of us. So does it mean the same emotions will happen to us? Or is it only the, you know, expression of Arjuna, is the question. It's a very basic question. So I just thought if somebody can, you know, throw light on this. Because all other emotions, raga, dvesha, kama, krodha, everything is associated to us. Even in the first chapter we had, you know, raga, soham, moham. It's all, you know, basically human emotions. So this is an emotion at a different level. So Arjuna is getting the Divya Chakshu, and then he is having 3 emotions. So is that emotions also going to be, you know, a part of our realization, is the question.
Srini, just one I think I have read this something somewhere, not able to place it. When Arjuna gets to see the Vishwarupam through the Divya Chakshu, it is a borrowed Divya Chakshu. Okay?
Correct.
So which is why it's one, a sense of wonderment, and then a fear, and then surrender. Okay? Right? But if we were to travel and obtain the Divya Chakshu, we would have probably crossed those emotions before we realize that God is everything else. Right? That's one reflection I have.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think this is what Swami P also says, which is that this was given by Bhagwan rather than acquired naturally. And therefore, he had fear. And apparently, eventually, he asks Krishna to take away this Divya Chakshus because he can't handle them. So I think it was artificial in a certain way, but it didn't come naturally, and that's why he had this wonderment. So I haven't gotten that far, so I'm just assuming that's the challenge.
No, that's well said, Subbu and Ajay. I think the important thing what I feel here is it need not be sequential in that same fashion, wonder, fear, and surrender. Okay, if something else in a different sequence it happens, then maybe the other two may not happen or whatever, right? It does not. For example, people who are seeped into bhakti tradition may not even think about wonder and fear. They have already overcome that particular thing. So I don't think it matters. But having said that, quote unquote, at a very theoretical level, my personal experience is that when I sometimes in my early stages of when doing sadhana, in the early stages when you meditate, when I meditated personally, I had to open my eyes and get off the meditation because it was really, there was a little bit of a fear, something that happened, okay? And I can't explain it, okay? You would reach a state where you would say, I don't think I can do this anymore. I have to get out of this meditation, okay? And that is not wonder. I can't even say it is fear, but that's not even surrender. It's neither. You just don't want it, okay? I don't know how to express it, but maybe some days when you experience it, maybe you'll empathize with me. Okay. So it happens, but I think it will happen in sadhana over a period of time.
I want to respond to that, talking about chapter 6 again in meditation, because Krishna says in a successful meditation, the meditator is canceled. And because of that, we can have fear, identifying ourselves as the ego, as the individual. Don't stamp me out. Oh, no, get rid of me. But he says, when you do surrender, then there is wonder. So again, your point, it doesn't have to be in any order. That is a reality of meditation. The meditator must go.
Go, yeah. That phase, I can completely empathize with you. But at some point, you go beyond that phase of fear goes away.
It's also the fear of losing the identity, right? When you do something identity, like this.
That's what it is. Exactly what it is. Losing the self-identity. For a fleeting moment.
But ultimately, because it is the misidentification, getting rid of it can only be a good thing.
Exactly. And once that thing happens, then open-eyed meditation becomes much more easier than closed-eyed meditation. Mm-hmm. That's where I found that's when the transition from looking from Ekarupa to Anekarupa becomes very, very easy. Try it out.
So I can respond from two, what my guru's experience and what he gave to me, right? Personal experience. So when my guru had this Vishwarupa, he was young, he did not have a strong guru at that life. So he was afraid, he got into fear, he thought he was caught by a ghost. But he experienced this whole 360 degree and, you know, he thought something went wrong and he was caught by a ghost. And then he goes up to his acharya and then she tells, no, you're caught by God, right? So that was his experience when he first time experienced it. But for me, because I'd worked with my guru for many years, when he gifted me a Vishwarupa Darshan, I knew that he was gifting it. There was absolute trust, and I knew my guru could never do wrong to me, anything scare me. So it was an absolute blissful surrender with no fear. Wonderment and surrender. That's the sequence it was. Wonderment because just, wow, I mean, this is true. And what he's been talking all these years can be experienced wonderment and just surrender, because that he's the one who gifted it, right? I did not do anything to get there. It's like, you know, you can buy a dollar and get you win $1 billion in lottery, right? You cannot say I deserve this $1 billion, right? I work for this $1 billion. That's exactly how the experience was. You know, nothing I could have done could have just, he just gifted it. When he gifted it, it was just pure wonderment and a total surrender to his feet. And that's how my guru's experience and my personal experience. So Mukku, again, it may not be universal, just sharing a perspective. So
when you give your talk next week, Mukku, I would really want to hear about sort of your Shurupa experience.
Sure, I can do that. Yeah.
So,
that moment is the only thing, my whole sadhana was just for that. If I reflect on it, that experience is all, the whole life is worth it, multiple lives is worth it, just that experience. And that's the guru, that's what to me the guru can give. You know, that's amazing.
So, does it mean at some point of the spiritual sadhana, we will be given this, Vishwarupa Darshan? I mean, either by a guru who is there, or, you know, by some eternal guru, so that we can experience this after we get mature enough. Is that what is going to happen?
Yes.
Yes. I think once you meet a Sadguru, he will give you that experience. It's normally a gift. And if you look at every enlightened master's life, you will see that happening. Whether it is Vivekananda's life or every enlightened master, if you read their biography, there's always a point in time the Guru will gift that experience.
Perfect. Understood.
Like Yogananda, if you look at Yogananda's biography, he gets that, Yukteswar gives him that experience. Vivekananda, again.
But the word experience has to be understood properly.
Yes.
That's also important.
Yeah, that's why they will prepare you to understand it. Otherwise, if it's given, you think it's something else happened, right? Like the ghost caught you, like the way my Guru first perceived it.
Understood. Thanks.
All right. 7:31 on my
just on that point, Rajesh, a quick one. I believe there is a date, I think 1st of January 1886 or something like that, where apparently Ramakrishna gave that blessings to his closest disciples. It's apparently an important date in the Ramakrishna calendar. And so I'm just wondering if that is similar to what Mukku was talking about, where Ramakrishna touches a lot of his closest disciples on one of the days when he's feeling like giving away, grace to everyone or divinity to his disciples. And it is now celebrated as a proper festival, apparently. And they all feel it, and then they come out of their trance in a day or two. And they feel it in different ways, depending on their sort of vasanas or whatever. So I'm wondering, Mukku, if that's similar to what you were talking about.
Yeah, you can say that to be similar. It's a Kalpathuru day, they call it.
Yeah, Kalpathuru day, exactly. Yeah, that's the day, correct.
Yeah, it's a very similar phenomenon, exactly. When the master just can gift the gift.
Okay.
All right. Any last comments on today's satsang before we conclude? We are 2 minutes over time.
I think wonderful discussion. I think we are a treasure out of experiences. I think we should learn from each other. Thank you, Rajesh. Yeah.
All right. Let's conclude with a prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramaya, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Maam Kaschid Dukkha Bhag Bhavet. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. Thanks, everyone. And next week, let's make sure that Mukku, you are joining on time and you are turning on your camera. And in the 30 minutes you have to talk about the Purnatva Tiktik from Shivagamas, as well as your Vishwarupa experience. And we'll continue with the other shlokas.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Hari Om. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hari Om. Thank you.